Whatever material was used in the cylinder's construction, it is far beyond our current understanding. Imagine a Stone Age man confronted with a solid steel door. Not only do we not know what this material is, we lack the technology even to begin to analyze it. Another man spoke up. I won't describe all of them, as they seemed interchangeable.
What are you saying, then? It's from another planet? It's from the future? What?
Father sighed. I knew why. He's never been a fan of what he calls fruitless speculation.
Your guess is as good as mine. I'm a scientist. I deal with facts.
Before he could go on, the same man spoke up again. Father hated being interrupted.
On the contrary, Professor Lofthouse, my guess is not as good as yours. My expertise regarding the security of this country surpasses your own. I also deal with facts, but, when necessary, I am prepared to use guesswork in the field. On some occasions, my guesses are good enough to save lives. Put aside your professional modesty, or pride, for the moment, and indulge me. Guess. Where did the item come from?
I couldn't prevent myself leaning forwards. Even in private, Father had never speculated along these lines. He put down his notes and paced in front of the blackboard.
Time travel is a meaningless theory, as there is no logical basis for it.
He scanned the room, but no one pushed him on the statement.
I could spend the rest of the day explaining why, but you asked me to guess. Likewise, the idea that this came from another planet, well, more feasible, but still unlikely. We saw no evidence of a craft, and the cylinder has no means of propulsion.
Might it not be the final component of a rocket-based ship, like the Moonlander?
Father nodded dubiously.
Well, it's possible, yes, but there is one huge flaw in that theory. Yes, the cylinder may be constructed from material that could withstand the heat generated when entering the Earth's atmosphere, but let me remind you once again that it has no means of propulsion. It would have fallen at a velocity between 200 and 400 miles per hour before striking the ground in the middle of one of the most densely populated cities in the world.
The university lecturer in him was fully present now, and he had picked up a piece of chalk, quickly sketching the imaginary trajectory of the cylinder as it headed for London.
How many reports did the authorities receive that day from witnesses to this event? Thousands? Hundreds?
No one spoke. We all know a rhetorical question when we hear one.
None. And when the cylinder was discovered, there was no physical evidence of an impact. No evidence at all. Gentlemen.
He does sometimes forget that I'm there.
I do not believe that the item came from beyond this planet.
He picked up the board rubber and erased his diagram before drawing a horizontal line halfway up the blackboard. He drew an X about 3 inches below the line.
No. The only hypothesis that makes sense is that the cylinder was already there. The new building in Marsham Street is to be a tower block, which means much deeper foundations than the building it is due to replace. The construction company uncovered the cylinder when they reached a depth of just over 5 meters. The material found at that depth in other parts of the city has been dated around the end of the Roman occupation of Britain.
The original questioner spoke up again almost immediately.
You're suggesting the item has been in that location since about 400 AD, just waiting to be discovered? And it's been dormant during that whole period?
Father frowned.
Well, I'm suggesting nothing. You asked for a guess, and now you have it.
It doesn't help as much, said another man.
We're no further forward. Hence my reluctance to guess. Can we move on to something vaguely empirical?
I'm not sure if his audience realized that this was also rhetorical, but if anyone had intended to ask another question, Father gave them no time to do so.
We do have a theory about Abos's recent development which fits the currently known facts.
Abos? Father grimaced. He had taken to using the name along with everyone else, but he couldn't hide his embarrassment when he explained it.
Oh, amorphous blob of slime.
He waved a hand in the air as if to distance himself from the name and then moved quickly on.
One of our team developed a nosebleed on the 11th of June. Some of the blood touched the cylinder and was absorbed by it.
I smiled a little at Father's slight obfuscation. It wouldn't do to admit that a pair of top scientists have resorted to fisticuffs.
Absorbed how? Good question, and another which we lack the knowledge to answer. However,
Father raised his hand to deflect an objection.
We can speculate in this instance based on observation.
He started to pace again. This was a sign of great excitement, although anyone who didn't know Father well would never have known it. Whatever the composition of the cylinder, we now know it has an organic element. We believe the blood started a process which led to the rapid changes we have recorded in the weeks since then. The cylinder is acting very much as a bird or reptile egg does, providing sustenance to Abos as he grows. In a sense, the blood fertilized the egg, but the process is asexual. The blood contains genetic information which has been used to create an organism almost identical to a human.
A clone?
No, a clone would be an exact copy of the original. Abos's physiology is based on Dr. Roger Sullivan, but there are noticeable differences between them. The main difference is scale. Dr. Sullivan is 5'11". Abos is 7'1". There are a few sharp intakes of breath around the table. Dr. Sullivan is in average physical condition for a man in his late 30s. Abos has the physique of a man at least 15 years younger. He looks like a trained athlete. It seems that the cylinder, in this egg form, has provided energy to enable Abos to grow a body based on Dr. Sullivan, but without imperfections and on a larger scale. The body itself stopped growing over a month ago, but if the fetal analogy still holds up, we believe brain development continues.
Well, this is all very well, Professor Lofthouse, but what next? What happens when Abos wakes up?
Ah. Father stopped pacing. We're back in the realm of guesswork.
What I'm asking, Professor,
it was the original questioner,
is whether this thing is a threat. What does it want? Is it friend or foe?
Hopkins stood up.
Gentlemen.
With Hopkins, the sexism is deliberate. He doesn't like me. Then again, I don't think he likes anyone. He just reserves a special store of contempt for females.
We don't yet know whether the item is an opportunity or a danger, but it is contained within the most secure facility in the country, deep underground, guarded by the most highly trained soldiers in the British Army. If the item is hostile, I can shut down this wing within seconds. If necessary, I can shut down the entire facility. And, as you are aware, the station itself can be destroyed if the Prime Minister orders it.
Father looked up sharply at that. Hopkins nodded.
Security is my concern, Professor. There was no need for you to know. If station is compromised, our last line of defense is to detonate the charges planted in the office block above our location. The entire complex would be buried under tons of rubble.
I coughed. Several heads swiveled my way in surprise as if to see me there. Men.
And how do we get out, if that happens?
We don't, Miss Lofthouse. Thank you both for your time today.
And with that, we were dismissed. Both of us were quiet for the rest of the day. It's a sobering thought. If Abos is deemed to be a threat to national security, we might all die down in those charmless catacombs by Liverpool Street Underground Station. August 29th, 1978. Oh, it happened. He's awake. Take a deep breath, Cress. I'm still shaking. I can't stop myself. I've been sitting at that table day after day, waiting for a change. Watching Abos stretching his impressive physique, his Roger-like face and impassive mask. Although I'm present at a scientific miracle, I've had to remind myself of that fact now and then, because honestly, I've been bored. I could only admit it in these pages, but it's the truth. I've taken to bringing paperbacks into work with me. Lurid, cheap, and corny romances, but they are easy to put down and pick up again without losing the thread. We watch Abos in shifts, and when it's my turn, I dig out my book and read. I wish they'd do something about the covers. It's bad enough that I'm enjoying stories about strong, arrogant, dominant men proving impossible to resist. The heroines may seem feisty, intelligent, and strong on the outside, but introduce a muscular builder called Tom, who's rebuilding his life after a spell in prison, and suddenly it's all furtive glances, breathless exchanges, and heaving bosoms. Not that I'm in any position to criticise. I can't get enough of it. I'm ashamed to say Emily Pankhurst owes me a big slap. I sit on the far side of the table so the guards at the door can't see the book cover. This morning, after checking Abos for any changes, I allowed myself to get immersed in a scene where Clara, the kitchen girl, was rudely asked by her employer to clean his shoes while he was wearing them, because he was late for a meeting. She's secretly studying to be a doctor and suspects her boss has early rheumatoid arthritis, but she doesn't know how to broach the subject,
while kneeling in front of him as he stares down her blouse. Okay, it's trash. I admit it. There's something about it I like. Don't judge. I was enjoying this passage and wondering why it was getting warmer in the lab when I was struck with the feeling that someone was watching me. Growing up with a scientist father, I'd asked him about this sensation before, as it seemed to defy logic. He had been dismissive, not unkindly, but firmly.
Oh, you probably imagine you're being watched a dozen times every day, Cress. One time in 50, you look up sharply and someone is staring right at you, so you give credence to the theory that somehow you felt the weight of their attention without the use of your normal senses. You conveniently forget the 49 previous occasions where no such coincidence occurred. You also fail to take into consideration the possibility that your sudden movement, when you raised your head to look up, may have caused someone to glance your way.
Which is all very well, but when the feeling came over me this morning, it was so powerful that I deliberately didn't look up right away. I stopped reading, gently removed my glasses, then slowly raised my eyes to watch the soldiers on either side of the door. Neither of them was looking at me, just talking quietly to each other. As I looked across the table at the far end of the room, I abruptly became aware of the only other possible candidate that might have provoked my intuition. I believe I stopped breathing for a few moments, then allowed my eyes to drop and refocus on the table right in front of me. Abos's eyes were open. His eyes were as golden as an autumn sunset, and he was looking right at me. There was a protocol for this moment. We had all discussed it. On the desk behind me was a button which, when pressed, would cause a red light to flash outside the lab door. An alarm would also begin to sound, although the subtle sound that had been chosen for it was designed to attract attention rather than cause concern or panic in either us or Abos himself. I didn't press it. I ignored the protocol. I couldn't stop looking into those eyes. I started breathing again, albeit in shallow gasps, wet my lips and prepared myself to speak. This, after all, was the moment when humanity would first communicate with a being outside of all known species. This could be an alien visitor, a theory which still had some traction amongst the station hierarchy despite Father's scepticism. I had a flash of panic remembering Neil Armstrong's slight fluffing of his own line when stepping onto the moon's surface. I thought of the way I had felt when I heard Dr. King's "I Have a Dream" speech. I made a huge effort to compose myself. I was determined to make this good. I smiled at his beautiful face and prepared to make history. "Hi, Abos," I said. "How are you?" "Oh, God." Abos swung his legs around and raised himself up to a seated position facing me. I was dimly aware of the soldiers reacting, one of them hitting the button by the door. The low-key alarm began to sound. Abos smiled at me. He smiled. At me. I felt the blood drain from my head, pinpricks of light appearing at the edges of my vision. Then he spoke. "Hi, Cress. I'm fine, thanks. How are you?" He had a wonderful voice, and his accent was British, which I only thought about later. I suppose I'd expected him to sound American like Roger. As I fainted, I know, how embarrassing a 19th century of me. The last thing I saw was his beautiful naked form springing from the table and catching me as I fell sideways from my chair. Chapter 11. September 3rd, 1978. Today, I was told I'd be allowed to spend time with Abos again. After my initial reaction and subsequent debrief, Hopkins was against letting me engage with the asset at all. He never referred to Abos as anything other than the item before now. I'm not sure I like this new term any better. According to Hopkins, I am too much of an unknown in this situation. I am no scientist. I am only here to record events as they unfold. It's a good job I've been thorough with my duties. At least Hopkins couldn't claim I was incompetent. Still, for a few days I thought I would be sacked. Hopkins considered my response to Abos to be a demonstration of civilian female frailty, and he suggested my immediate transfer. Father, McCain, Mike, and Roger argued against this, but ultimately they have no power in station. I was sent home. I moped. Even the kitchen girl and her arrogant but irresistible employer couldn't hold my attention. All I could think about were those incredible golden eyes. "Don't get the wrong idea, dear diary.
Just because Abos looks like a perfected version of a man I once found attractive, and he has beautiful eyes, does not mean that I am experiencing some kind of silly romantic delusion. I do not know precisely what Abos is, but I can be sure for one thing, he is not human. I have watched him change from a large bowl of unappetizing mushy peas to a strong, handsome man with the body of a Greek god. But I still remember the mushy peas. I must never forget the mushy peas. Last night, Father told me the good news. He was pleased, but also a little wary. I found out why when he broke with tradition and, after pouring his own J&B, took out another glass and poured one for me. We sat in front of the fire. Today was the first day I've lit it since Easter.
"I'd like you to come back, Chris," he said. "Let's start the educational program you suggested. Primary school level."
"Oh, don't tell me Hopkins has had a change of heart. I didn't even know he had a heart."
"Well, I don't believe that man is capable of changing his mind. I've never known anyone less flexible. No, Chris, he doesn't want you back."
I stared at him, confused. He took a long swallow of his whiskey.
"Abos wants you back. He asked for you."
I took an even longer swallow of whiskey. J&B whiskey is very close to the colour of his eyes. Oh, dear, I'm still doing it.
"How?
When?"
"Well, it started yesterday. We've all tried speaking to Abos, but other than saying hello and exchanging basic pleasantries, he has very little to say. He shows no real curiosity, allows himself to be prodded and poked around, but is strangely passive. He makes no demands."
Father told me how they managed to get a blood sample. At first, needles would snap when they tried to do it. But when Abos showed signs of understanding what they needed, he took the needle himself and slowly pushed it into a vein. It was all for nothing, though, because the blood type was type O and showed no abnormalities.
"Well, he let us run basic physical tests but showed no interest in them, and then this morning he turned to me and said, 'Where's Cress?'"
All my whiskey had gone. Father topped me up.
"He stopped cooperating on the remaining tests, but he continued to ask where you were. I asked if he would like you to come in tomorrow, and he said yes. Hopkins has agreed, although all teaching materials will have to be cleared by his staff before use."
I grinned. The smile I was trying for was meant to look calm, professional and controlled. It was supposed to reassure Father that I would be fine. I don't really think the grin helped at all. He stood up and paced a little. He scratched his earlobe every few seconds. This meant he was excited and worried. I could tell there was something he hadn't yet told me, and he was looking for the right words. It was very unusual for Father to struggle this way. The last clear memory I have of him in a similar fix was when he told me about Mother's illness. "Just tell me," I said, and he stopped pacing. "I'm 29 years old, Father. I'm not a little girl anymore." He smiled at that and managed to stop pacing, although his hand went to his earlobe again.
"Abos was shown around certain areas of station today. Hopkins took personal charge of the tour. He showed no curiosity and didn't question anything. When we got back to the lab, I pushed at the door, but it didn't open immediately."
I nodded. The lab door was steel, solid, heavy, and often tricky to open without putting your shoulder into the job.
"Abos was right behind me. He gave the door a push. It came off its hinges, buckled slightly where he had pushed it, and ended up halfway across the lab. The two soldiers on duty lifted their weapons, but Hopkins shouted at them to stand down. Abos just walked in as if nothing untoward had happened."
My grin seemed even less appropriate now.
"Oh, Cressida, we know virtually nothing about this creature. You're my only daughter. You're all I have left of Mary. No one can force you to do this. I'm not at all convinced that you should, but you're right, you're not a little girl. It is your decision."
I remember the smile on his face when he looked at me. Father was right. We don't know what Abos is, but I can't believe he would hurt me. "I'll do it," I said.
Chapter 12. Tilkley Park looked different at night. The security lights were triggered by a motion detector. But since only three small lights still worked, the intended effect was lost. Once inside my favourite office building, the lights clicked off again. I waited for almost an hour before concluding no one was coming to check. I looked out the window. It was a dark night. but even the shadows seemed to have deeper, more suspicious shadows. I could have sworn I saw figures moving on at least 5 separate occasions, and I held my breath, staring into blackness without blinking. For someone who, it seemed likely, couldn't be harmed, I was bloody scared. At about 2 in the morning, I curled up on the floor in a fetal position and cried like a giant baby. Eventually, exhausted and unable to think straight, I fell asleep. By the time I was old enough to understand it, the joke that went, "Just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get me," was already so cliched, it was practically meaningless. It popped into my mind a couple of hours later when I opened my eyes, my head resting on a solid cement bag. I had heard a noise. Nothing loud, nothing obvious. Something so subtle, it might have gone unnoticed. But it had woken me. I knew every sound in Tilkley Park by then. The scurrying of rats, the creak of door frames expanding and contracting, the almost musical note of the wind finding gaps in boarded-up windows. This sound was new. I waited to hear it again, keeping perfectly still, my breathing as calm as I could make it. Finally, as I was beginning to suspect I had been dreaming, it came again. It was the sound of footsteps, but there was something unusual about it. Something that made me doubt I'd heard it at all. It was as if dozens of people moved at once, in a kind of light-footed run lasting about 4 or 5 seconds. Then it stopped for half a minute, before being repeated. It was getting closer. I got up slowly, first rolling away from the cement bag, then rising to my feet. My knees cracked and I froze for a second. I stretched my arms and legs, feeling like I'd aged 20 years while sleeping on the hard floor. My bladder was killing me. I tried to think about something else. I thought about the footsteps and imagined a platoon of highly trained armed soldiers convening on my position, surrounding me. That didn't help my bladder at all. I moved as slowly as I could towards the window with the knot hole in its wooden board, all the while berating myself for imagining something as ridiculous as a platoon of soldiers surrounding me. I looked out of the knot hole, blinking against the sudden daylight. There was no sign of anything different at first. Then the noise came again, and I saw them. A platoon of highly trained armed soldiers was convening on my position, surrounding me. "Oh, bollocks," I whispered. I looked around. There was a door at the front, a second door behind me, padlocked like the first, led to a small courtyard. There were windows on either side. I crept to one of them and found a gap to peer through. I saw no soldiers at first. Then a weak burst of early morning sun broke through the clouds, and something flashed on the roof of the building opposite. I looked up and saw the top of a green helmet, visible over the barrel and sights of a long, lethal-looking rifle. I backed away. The mind of an experienced fighter automatically clicks into a ratified state of high alert in a crisis. It processes strategy, assesses 3 or 4 escape options, chooses one that might work, then takes action. My mind, on the other hand, doesn't work that way at all. I've improved since, but I still remember precisely how I reacted at that moment. 2 distinct mental events occurred simultaneously. The first was me wondering why the manufacturers of rifles hadn't yet come up with a way to stop sunlight glinting off the scope, giving away the sniper's position. I'd seen it happen in a few films over the years, and here, it was in real life. It was a basic design flaw, embarrassing. The second mental event was the onset of an earworm. "Don't Worry, Be Happy" by Bobby McFerrin started playing in my head. Before I could stop myself, I was whistling along, and I couldn't stop. All in all, my response to a life-threatening situation was less than optimal. I had no idea who these people were. "Don't worry." But given the otherwise shoddy security arrangements at Tilkley Park, I was sure they weren't the 24-hour security firm mentioned on the rusting signs. "Be happy." When I'm anxious, I eat. To be fair, when I'm unhappy, tense, excited, nervous, happy, tired or bored, I eat. I'd left a bunch of bananas to ripen in the office, as I had read that they were an excellent source of slow-releasing carbohydrates. I started unpeeling and eating them as I paced, opening a couple of packets of malt loaf and adding them to my unconventional breakfast. I might need all the energy I could get. The truth of what was happening, obvious as it was in hindsight, hit me as I chewed. If Mum had kept demanding the deterrent admit he was my father, perhaps the government or the army would have kept tabs on her. Maybe even gone as far as tapping her phone. In which case, they would have known about the reporter coming to interview her. They would have heard whatever she told him that made him so keen. They might have been watching the house ever since. In which case, I'd led them to a secluded spot miles away from any witnesses. And I'd gone to sleep there, giving them plenty of time to call in as many soldiers as they thought it might take to capture someone with enhanced physical abilities. No one could know what I was capable of. I didn't even know that myself yet. But they would be crazy not to err on the side of caution. They now suspected Mum's claim was true, which meant they were dealing with the son of a bona fide superhero. For all they knew, I might be able to fly. I heard the distant sound of rotor blades. They obviously wanted me pretty badly, whoever they were. I knew what happened when the government departments got hold of people with strange powers. I read the comics and books. I'd seen the films. They experimented on them. And, given whoever was out there had turned up en masse, heavily armed and with helicopters, I had no reason to believe their intentions were benign. I came up with a plan. It was a completely crap plan. I looked at the boarded-up window I'd used as my entrance. Two nails held it in place. If I hit it at speed, the board would give easily, and I'd be outside. I'd have the element of surprise. I picked up two cement bags. I could lob them at the first soldiers to show themselves. Then I could sprint for the fence, jump it, and run like hell. Like I said, it was a crap plan. It also relied on the fact that I hoped they wanted to take me alive. A super-powered corpse wouldn't be much good to them. There was the possibility that I was wrong, and they were willing to shoot me. Skewers, electric carving knives and drills were one thing, but bullets were another. I didn't know if my skin could repel bullets, and since the only way of finding out was to have someone shoot me, I was in no hurry to put it to the test. I stuffed the last banana in my mouth and paced back from the window until my back was against the wall. I started whistling the Bobby McFerrin tune again, which sounded even worse around the banana. I gave myself a countdown. 3. I braced one leg on the wall behind me. 2. I stopped whistling and tensed my body. 1. I stared at the spot on the board I was aiming to smash through. My heart was beating so hard I could feel it in my teeth. There was a knock on the door. A brisk tap, tap, tap. Businesslike, no nonsense. I stayed where I was, my eyes flicking to the door, then back to the window.
Good morning, Daniel.
The voice was upper class, clipped, military sounding. I imagined a moustache.
My name is Colonel Hopkins. I was your father's commanding officer. May I come in?
Chapter 13. September 4th, 1978. What an afternoon. I'm still struggling to take it in. I attended the meeting of the scientific team, convened to discuss and compare their reports from the past few days. Father wasn't at the meeting. One member of the team stays close to Abos at all times. They are finding out more and more about Abos's capabilities day by day. The evidence suggests these abilities are still developing, as was demonstrated by video footage Mike showed at the beginning of the meeting. The footage was filmed in the lab. Abos was sitting in front of the metal table. That was my first shock. He was wearing clothes. Not just any clothes, but a British Army uniform. I asked about it, but Roger cut me off. It's tailor-made. Hopkins gave us no choice about his outfit, and Abos showed no particular interest. Now, watch. On the projector screen, Abos was picking up objects as they were placed on the table. A 2x4 plank of wood was first. I heard McKean's voice off camera.
This is your pine, Abos. Can you try and break it? We like to test your strength today.
So they decided to keep calling him Abos. I suppose the habit was too hard to break. I wonder what we'll say if Abos ever asks what his name means. He picked up the plank, studied it, then snapped it between his hands, seemingly with no effort. The next item was also a plank, thicker this time, made of oak. It gave Abos no more trouble than the pine. A selection of progressively stronger materials was brought in by the soldiers on duty, and, one at a time, placed on the table before Abos bent or snapped them. Plastics, composites, glass, metal, alloys, steel. He showed no signs of physical strain. The final item was so small I had trouble making it out. As I fumbled for my glasses, the camera zoomed in to show a diamond on a black mat. Abos picked it up between finger and thumb, looked at it with little curiosity, and then squeezed. I saw his thumb and finger meet. A trickle of fine dust fell back to the table as he rubbed what remained of the diamond from his skin. "Oh, goodness," I said, looking at Roger. I couldn't help comparing the original Roger with the man on screen who had somehow become a close copy. Roger did not fare well in the comparison. I fancy he had an inkling about what I was thinking because he scowled and pointed at the screen.
"Pay attention, this is what we wanted you to see. We filmed this 2 days ago, it was the first time you did it."
"Did what?" I said as I turned back to the screen. One soldier was bending over the table to remove the diamond dust. As he brushed the dust into his hand, Abos made a small gesture towards him. There was a loud crack. The soldier yelped in surprise and jumped back from the table. Instinctively, he went to lift his weapon. It fell apart in his hands. I stared at the screen in disbelief. Without turning, I said, "Can you wind that?" Roger was already doing it. I watched the same few moments over and over again until there could be no doubt about what had happened. When the soldier stepped forwards, his gun looked normal. The loud crack occurred at the precise moment Abos made his gesture, which, once I had watched it a few times, looked like he had taken hold of an invisible key and was turning it in a lock. When the soldier grabbed his weapon, it fell away into its individual parts. I started to ask a question, but Roger again anticipated my thoughts.
"Oh, they took it away and screwed it all together again. It worked. It's as if it were stripped back to its pre-assembly state, but he's done it 3 times since when someone with a weapon has been close to him. Hopkins has ordered his men to maintain a distance of at least 6 feet from Abos at all times."
I gaped at him, considering the implications. "So, Abos can influence matter without touching it?" In answer, Mike loaded another film and let it play.
"We filmed this yesterday."
I recognized the dining hall. It's called the mess hall, but as I have joined none of my country's armed forces, I refuse to adopt all of their silly jargon. Father was there this time, as was Roger and Hopkins. There were 2 soldiers at the door, 4 more in the room, all armed. It didn't seem to worry Abos, who, as usual, appeared oblivious to his surroundings. There's a placid, passive quality about him which intrigues me. Physically, he is literally head and shoulders above anyone else, and he has a powerful impact on anyone who sees him. But he doesn't seem to notice this, or much else, for that matter.
"This was his first meal outside of the lab," said Roger. "We wanted to know how he would react to a change of scene."
On the screen, Abos, Father, Roger, and Hopkins had taken a seat at one of the tables and were eating. It looked like Irish stew. It had been filmed yesterday, Saturday. Definitely Irish stew, then. Ugh, poor Abos. The station's culinary offerings were poor at the best of times, but their attempt at Irish stew was an insult to the palate. Again, it didn't appear to affect Abos, who ate it without enthusiasm or disgust. Another thought crossed my mind and wouldn't go away. I began. "Does Abos ever... what I mean to say is, does he need to... well...
take a crab?"
"Americans do have a way of cutting to the heart of things, don't they? Although Roger can be a little crude." "Well, yes. Does he?"
"He does. Once a day. He sleeps from 2 till 6, then he uses the john, takes a pee that lasts the best part of a minute, then follows it with a crap. We showed him how to use the bathroom after the first time when he did it in his clothes."
"Oh, I'm rather glad I wasn't around to see that. Might have tarnished the Adonis-like image somewhat."
"We've tested his stools and his urine. It's all normal, like his blood, which is impossible, of course, as we know he's not human. Oh, here we go. Watch this."
On screen, Hopkins was saying something to Abos, who was looking at him with the same inscrutable expression. For an inappropriate moment, he reminded me of Lucky, the Labrador I'd had as a child. Sometimes I'd look at Lucky and he'd look back at me, and much as I adored him, I could feel a gulf between us.
An untraversable distance hinted at by the expression in those eyes. I was a girl, and he was a dog. Now I was a woman. What was Abos? Hopkins was waving a hand towards the adjoining tables. The solid oak tables could seat 8 people on the benches each side. Abos turned his head towards the table. Almost immediately, the whole thing rose into the air as if it had been a plastic toy tied to a bunch of helium balloons. About 6 feet up, it stopped, hovering. Hopkins glanced at the table before returning his focus to Abos, his expression intense. Abos was taking another mouthful of gristly stew. I couldn't hear what Hopkins was saying as the film had no sound, but as Abel stuck a fork into a dumpling, which, if you'd ever tried Station's dumplings, you'd accept as another demonstration of his inhuman strength, every other table, apart from their own, flew upwards to the same level as the first. The soldiers positioned around the room reacted by moving forwards, taking their rifles from their shoulders and holding them in a ready position. Abel looked up from his stew. He stood up. Hopkins said something to the soldiers and they lowered their weapons. I saw Father and Roger watching Abos intently as he approached the nearest soldier, who was doing his best not to be terrified. Abos held his hand out as if to take the gun. The soldier took half a step backwards, then, at a command from Hopkins, handed the rifle to Abos. The next few moments were fascinating, but must have been incredibly tense. Abos studied the weapon in his hands, turning it first this way, then that. He examined the trigger mechanism before doing something I couldn't see as he had turned away from the camera.
He checked the chamber.
Roger's voice had a slight tremor. I felt a flicker of trepidation. What was I about to watch? Abos turned back and was holding the gun by the barrel, looking into it. There was a sick look on the young soldier's face. No doubt it had been drummed into him by years of training that it was a bad idea to stare down the barrel of a loaded weapon. Then Abos placed his other hand on the trigger. The horror of that moment was so palpable that I felt like I was in the dining hall with them. A huge figure, the rifle looking small in his hands, surrounded by shocked and helpless men as 19 solid oak tables floated above them. When the small puff of smoke emerged from the barrel and Abos's head jerked back, I clapped a hand over my mouth to stop myself from screaming. Then every table fell out of the sky, hitting the floor at the same moment. One of them hit a soldier and I saw him spin away as the camera fell, knocked by the impact. I realized I had looked away from the screen. I forced myself to look back. There was little to see as the camera had ended up on its side. Broken tables, feet rushing backwards and forwards. One pair of feet moved more slowly, with no indication of panic. No shoes. I realized it could only be Abos, as his feet were probably too big to fit into the largest army boot. I found out later they are having some made for him. I looked away from the screen. Roger was shaking his head slowly.
I've watched it 12 times, but I can still hardly believe it, although I was there.
Is he okay? My voice was probably a little shrill, but I had just seen Abel shoot himself in the throat, and despite the film of his feet, I could only assume he was horribly injured. How badly was he hurt?
Roger shrugged in an unconvincing display of nonchalance. Oh, he's fine. Keep watching. You will want to see the last part. By the way, the soldier who was hit by the table broke his arm in 2 places, but he'll be okay, just in case you were worried at all.
I barely heard him. On screen, the camera moved again as someone picked it up and steadied the tripod. I was looking at Roger's face, sweaty and scared. He stared into the lens for a second, then held his hand up. On his palm, there was a small metal disc about the size of a halfpenny. The film stopped and Roger flicked on the lights.
Well?
Well, what? I said. Am I supposed to know what that means? Just tell me if he's okay. What was that in your hand? A coin? He laughed. He actually sounded a little scared.
That was the bullet. It hit him in the neck at point-blank range, and that was the result. Abos doesn't even have a bruise.
Chapter 14. Colonel Hopkins had a moustache, just as I'd suspected. I waited while one of his men used bolt cutters to snap the padlock on the door. Then Hopkins walked calmly in, his cap under his arm, a briefcase in his hand. He indicated an empty holster at his side.
I'm unarmed, Mr. Harbin. I am not here to hurt you.
He looked up at me, at the cement bags in my hands. Not that I imagine I could. He waited, and, after a few seconds, I dropped the bags. There was a loud bang as they hit the floor, and Hopkins barked an order over his shoulder. "Stand down!" I hadn't heard anyone move outside, but in my mind's eye I saw dozens of guns trained on the doorway, soldiers ready to rush me if Hopkins gave the word. He walked across the room and sat on the stairs. I sat on the pile of cement bags. "I won't lie to you, Daniel." I suspected he was about to do just that, but he was more subtle. Gave me an edited version of the truth. It would be decades before I found out all of Station's dirty secrets. "Your father was not quite as pure as his press office wanted to believe, I'm afraid. We became aware, well after the events in question, of some of his, extracurricular visits to women. We did not appreciate the scale of the problem until the news of the first pregnancy appeared in a national newspaper." He nodded at me. "Your mother's pregnancy, Daniel. As far as we know, she was the first. I admit we were gravely disappointed when she shared her news with the press. But you must remember that we thought, at the time, that she was lying." "You had your chance to do the right thing," I said. "She called. She wrote. I've seen the letters. You did nothing." Hopkins was impassive. "Daniel, we've received dozens of letters every day for years, suggesting all sorts of nonsense about the deterrent. Your mother's claims seem no different. When we discovered that the deterrent had, indeed, been promiscuous, we began to monitor all women who had contacted us." "You spied on them." "Not all of them. Even if we had wanted to, we do not have unlimited resources. In the interests of national security, we tapped your mother's telephone, and we checked on you regularly after your birth. Once a month at first, then annually. When you started school, we stopped visiting, as you had shown no hint of the abilities you now possess." I said nothing. I thought there was an element of bluffing going on. How could this man know anything about my powers? Mum didn't know about my abilities. Just that I'd grown over half a foot over the summer and become a lump of solid muscle. No one had seen what I was doing at Tilkley Park. I was pretty sure of that. When he saw I wasn't going to comment, he continued. "The intelligence we received suggested your abilities became apparent during adolescence. I understand you experienced puberty recently, Daniel." I went red. "Since making that link, we have traced other women in our files. We can only find those who previously contacted us. There may be others who told no one that they were visited by the deterrent. Daniel?" I looked at him. He held my gaze. "Of the 12 children we've found, 9 of them have gone through puberty. They all died. In the cases where we were able to perform post-mortems, the bodies displayed dangerous internal changes, rapid growing tumors that shut down vital organs." I didn't think he was bluffing now. Somehow, I knew he was telling the truth. I don't mean that in a kind of woolly, new-agey, I just like, you know, got a feeling kind of way. I thought it might be another ability linked to my physical changes. My mind felt sharper somehow, more engaged with reality, and I found I could tell a great deal about people from their facial expressions, their posture. I'd seen an interview on the news a couple of nights ago and had known the politician being questioned was lying. Hopkins was telling the truth. Or at least he believed he was, which isn't always the same thing. If he was right, I wasn't the only child anymore. There were half-brothers and half-sisters out there somewhere. Or at least there had been. They had hit puberty and it had killed them. "Daniel, we don't believe you're in any immediate danger, although I'd like you to check in with our medical staff as soon as possible. And I want you to know that the soldiers outside are only here as a precaution. I'm here to make you an offer. Chance to find out who you really are, and serve your country, if that's what you choose." He kept talking, but I was tuning him out and thinking fast. The last thing he had said had been a lie. There would be no choice. I knew he intended to bring me in, and he was telling the truth about serving my country, although I didn't much like the sound of that. I never wanted to be a soldier. I had a feeling I wouldn't be very good at taking orders, especially from a mustachioed prat like Hopkins. No. When he talked about serving my country, everything in his voice, face, and body told me I would do so with or without my consent. I didn't know how he could be so confident they could force me to do anything. I didn't intend hanging around long enough to find out. The rotor blades were louder. If I was going to do something, it would have to be soon. If I left it any longer, I'd be up against whatever the helicopters were bringing, and the soldiers I'd already seen. And if they managed to take me in, they'd lock me somewhere so secure I'd never get out. Then they'd have all the time in the world to experiment on me, which was surely what they intended to do. And who would ever find out? I mean, after the way I left, Mum wouldn't be expecting a call or a postcard.
What do you say?
Hopkins had reached the end of his pitch.
Come outside, Daniel. We have transport on the way. Ever been in a helicopter? I can answer any questions you might have while we're in the air.
He motioned towards the door. He was used to being obeyed. Everything about him radiated the arrogant assurance of a man well-versed in wielding power. Often, when someone exhibits that much confidence, it becomes difficult to resist. Hopkins showed no doubt. He knew I would walk through that door with him. I made up my mind, grabbed him by the throat and squeezed as gently as I could, making sure I closed his windpipe but didn't snap his neck. His eyes bulged in outraged disbelief. He went an interesting color, then sagged in my hand. I lowered him to the floor. I hoped that my plan's simplicity might compensate for what it lacked in other areas. I reviewed it. The plan. Run like hell. Yep. Good to go. Ignoring the door and the window, I ran headlong at the wall, putting my shoulder to it and crashing through in a cloud of brick dust and debris. Then I ran like hell. My plan relied heavily on the element of surprise. The doors and windows were being watched, but I doubted the soldiers were keeping their eyes on the walls. I had failed to factor in the reaction times and expertise of trained soldiers. My unusual choice of exit gained me about 0.3 seconds head start. I sprinted for the fence. It was about a 50-yard dash, which I could make in 6 seconds in optimal conditions. The conditions weren't optimal. The first tranquilizer dart hit my shoulder after I'd covered just a few yards. Then a second hit my right buttock. They both bounced off. So far so good, although I stumbled a little. On my right, I saw two men set off at speed, carrying something between them, aiming to intercept me before I reached the fence. I could see they wouldn't get there in time, so I discounted them. Other figures burst out from concealed positions and braced rifles against their shoulders.
Hold your fire!
Hopkins' second in command must have been ordered not to shoot me. That was good. Not being shot was good. I corrected my stumble and picked up my pace. A soldier on my left started swinging something. I ignored him and sighted my launch point about 4 strides away. There was no way they could anticipate how far and high I could jump. So all I had to do was... My legs abruptly snapped together. Something smacked into my shins hard, and I went face first into the gravel. I took a couple of seconds to roll over and react, which gave the snipers plenty of time to hit me with more darts. They stung a bit, didn't penetrate my skin, but delayed me enough for the first 2 soldiers to reach me. They threw something. A weighted net came down on top of me. I heard the sound of running footsteps. They were going to rush me. I was extremely glad I had eaten the bananas and malt loaf. Breakfast, the most important meal of the day. I felt the buzz start as I fought back. When I had been training, I'd focused on one task at a time and used whatever strength I needed to accomplish it. I hadn't forgotten how it had felt waking up in a field after destroying Piss Creature's car. Giving in to the temptation of using all my strength was fun. There was no other word for it. But, in retrospect, it was dangerous. Trying to satisfy an insatiable appetite for destruction by thumping inanimate objects was one thing. But how much control would I be able to maintain against flesh and blood? The rotors were louder now. I flexed the muscles in my legs and felt the rope tying them break. They'd used a bowler to bring me down. Multiple weights at each end of a rope which, when thrown, would wrap itself around the target. Illegal in the UK. A covert military outfit using illegal weapons? Shocking. The net was next. It wasn't normal rope. It was made of some kind of flexible metal. Strands of the stuff wound together, forming a tight webbing. I tore it like paper, even as the two soldiers reached me and clubbed me in the face with their rifle butts. Ignoring my assailants, I stood up and faced the fence. Just a few paces more and I'd be clear to jump. I registered the fact that the rotors were now very loud as two ropes dropped from the air, and soldiers swarmed down from the belly of the helicopter, like hyperactive spiders. Spiders with guns. I looked up. The side of the helicopter was open, and I could see burly men crouching behind an enormous machine gun. He was pointing the painful end at me.
Daniel!
I looked over my shoulder. Hopkins was made of stern stuff. He was holding a megaphone and walking towards me.
Please stop running. We don't want to hurt you.
One of the men with the net saw his chance at that moment and clubbed me from behind with his rifle. I flinched, turned and punched him in the chest. I heard ribs break as he left the ground, flew through the air, hit the fence and bounced back half the distance before coming to rest on his front. He didn't move.
Back away, barked Hopkins.
And the remaining soldiers retreated, their fingers still on the triggers of their weapons.
Hold your fire. You have your orders. Daniel, don't move.
It was too late. That last blow to my head was one too many. Even though I could see I was outnumbered and outgunned, my brain was way beyond making rational decisions. I ran, straight towards the helicopter, and jumped. The face of the guy behind the machine gun was a picture. I didn't know what orders he had been given, but I imagine they didn't cover dealing with a super strong assailant who could leap 20 feet straight up, using the top of the fence as a springboard, and join him in his aircraft. He took the most sensible course of action possible under the circumstances. He looked at me as I hauled myself in and jumped, grabbing a rope and rapidly lowering himself to the ground. I tore the machine gun free of its rivets and, grabbing the barrel, smashed it over and over into the metal floor. Bits flew off. A few rounds exploded. Then the barrel snapped off. I threw it out. By then, the pilots had realized something wasn't right. They had to choose between flying off with me on board or landing as quickly as possible. We hit the ground hard, straddling the fence, and I realized I was back where I started. I was past caring by then, and I ran towards the armed men.
Fire!
Hopkins' voice. It seemed that the orders had changed. As I reached the first two men and swung my arm, sweeping them to one side and knocking over three more, I felt sharp pains in my legs a fraction of a second before hearing the rapid fire from my left. I looked down at my legs. Shredded cloth flapped over my skin, which was red but unbroken. That answered my question about bullets. They couldn't penetrate my skin, but they bloody hurt. A lot. I turned and faced my attackers, reaching behind me and grabbing one of the soldiers I had knocked over. I got a good hold on the front of his combat jacket, then held him like a javelin. It was a decent shot, taking three more down. I felt more pain in my back this time. What had happened to aiming at my legs then? I turned and saw Hopkins pointing a handgun at me. So much for his fine talk about not wanting to hurt me. When he saw he had my attention, he fired straight into my stomach. I howled with rage and went for him. He sprinted back to the office, darting through the door. I was there 3 seconds later, just in time to see him jump through the window, screaming, "Now!" The grenade came in through the door behind me. I didn't even have time to acknowledge my stupidity before it burst apart with a loud crack, filling the enclosed space with smoke. The smoke smelled like French cheese, and that was the last thing I remember.
Chapter 15. September 5th, 1978. My first session with ABOS took place this morning. As station's lift has no visible cues to help me gauge how fast it's descending, I still have no idea how far underground we are. There are other levels below us, accessible only by stairs behind doors which require codes to open. I've never asked what's down there. Station is built on secrets, and too much curiosity might, I suspect, be rather a dangerous indulgence. Abos has been assigned living quarters on the first level, the only level the lift stops at. The same level as the lab. Just a 2-minute walk along the orange line corridor. To navigate the station labyrinth, we all follow the thin coloured lines painted at waist height on the drab walls. They seem to use the same colour system as the underground, or perhaps it's coincidental. Following the red central line leads you to the office of the colonel and his staff. The black northern line reputedly leads to a weapons testing area. I was very firmly discouraged from following it when I looked for the nearest toilet during my first week. If you're hungry, the purple bakerloo leads to food, which makes me wonder if the architect or designer had a sense of humour. So today, I followed the navy blue Piccadilly away from the lab to an area about a 3-minute walk away. I'd never been inside those rooms before. They'd always been locked. Whatever they had contained before had been cleared away, and the space, as one of Hopkins' men put it, repurposed. What an ugly expression. The rooms themselves still smelled of fresh paint. The soldiers tasked with decorating showed no imagination, using the same drab olive green that covers almost every wall in station. Occasionally, perhaps as an attempt to stop us going mad with the sheer monotony of the colour scheme, a grey wall makes an appearance. A more likely explanation is that they only use grey when they've run out of olive. Hopkins has allocated 3 rooms for Abos. One is a small bedroom. Another, a functional washroom with sink, toilet and shower. The biggest room, which was probably used as a storeroom judging by the shelves, contains a metal desk and 2 chairs. Light comes from a single bare bulb overhead. Not a picture on the wall. I rolled my eyes when I walked in. The whole place has all the charm of a police cell. Abos was waiting for me, sitting at the desk. It wasn't a small chair, but his bulk made him look like a grown-up squeezing onto a child's chair at primary school. He smiled when he saw me. Cress. He didn't stand up, but his face was nearly level with mine. I looked at his throat, but couldn't see any sign of where the bullet had hit his skin. Hello, Abos. It's good to see you again. He didn't reply. I put out my hand, and he looked at it blankly. This is one way that we greet each other. Hold out your right hand. Abos mirrored my action and lifted his left hand. That's your left hand, Abos. He dropped his hand and lifted the other. Right hand, he said. Yes. I put my hand in his, used my left hand to move his fingers into place. Then I gently moved both of our hands up and down, the traditional British 2.5 times. We call this shaking hands. He nodded. I took the other chair and sat at the end of the desk. There was a small pile of books waiting for me. I had to submit them to Hopkins' office for approval before being allowed to use them, although I questioned how much dangerous sedition might be found in the pages of the Ladybird ABC or Read and Write with Peter and Jane. I smiled up at him in what I hoped was a brisk professional way. Before we start, I have a question. Abos didn't respond at all to this. I'm still struggling with the idiosyncratic ways he interacts with me. Questions and answers are a case in point. In response to a question, he rarely reacts at all. Father mentioned this in the pep talk he gave me before I started this first lesson. Father is unsure about how much, if anything, can be read into Abos's facial expressions, or his choice of words. Because he looks very much like us. I didn't interrupt, but I wanted to add, yes, just taller, more handsome, bulletproof, able to move objects with his mind and with beautiful eyes like the colour of treacle. And he speaks the English language doesn't mean he is like us. I reassured Father, mentioning mushy peas. He looked confused. What is your question? I haven't described his speaking voice, have I? It's as if an aristocratic European had been taught the English language from a young age, but had never used it. Now, years after mastering it, he's called on to speak English constantly. He does it perfectly, but there are strange pauses. The odd hesitation, sometimes an odd use of a familiar word. Why did you ask for me, Abos?
For what did I ask for you, Cress?
I took a few moments to unpick what he meant, then gave up and rephrased my question. You told Professor Lofthouse and Colonel Hopkins that you wanted to see me. He nodded at this, a very human gesture. Yes, to see you and to hear you, to speak and listen. Why? Again, it looked as though I would not get an answer at all. Abos looked blankly at me for a few seconds, then he said,